I was kicked off Altar Guild at my church about 15 years ago for failure to iron properly. And anyway, they finally let me back in, but this is my first week doing the linens. It's not gone great, so thankfully another member of the Altar Guild is coming over to help me with it. But also, that was a big house I lived in at the time, and there were a lot of people there, I thought. That was my first March for Life in Washington, D.C. in 1998. I had done some in Colorado, where I'm from, prior to that. And I was actually thinking about this with what Lila Rose was talking about, being 9 years old and learning about abortion and how that shaped her, because that was the same age I was when I learned about abortion. And I still remember how I felt when my parents explained it to me, and I thought that it was the most ludicrous thing I had ever heard. I mean, I was horrified, I was confused, and to some extent that hasn't really, that's kind of still how I feel about the issue. And it's been something that I've cared about deeply since that age of 9, so maybe that's the magic age to tell your children if you want to have them grow up to care a lot about the issue. But what I was going to talk about today is how to be pro-life in a pro-death culture, and I just wanted to give a couple of examples of how that works in my life. I am senior editor at thefederalist.com, which is an online publication that started just over a year ago. We cover stories about politics and policy and culture, and it's been great. It's actually a publication I helped start, and we've had a lot of success with it. And we also get to write about life issues in a way that's very different from the way that most media talk about these things. So this week, as Carol referenced a little bit, what happened this week was that the pro-life members of Congress had promised pro-lifers that there would be a vote on a very important bill that would happen on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. So this had been something that pro-lifers had been promised for quite some time, that it would be sort of a way to celebrate the 42nd anniversary, this horrible 42nd anniversary. And all of a sudden, at the last minute, it all completely fell apart. And what was interesting about it was that the bill would be a ban on late-term abortions. These are abortions that are only allowed in, I believe, 4 countries, 2 of which are China and North Korea, and 1 of which is us. And that is not company you want to keep when it comes to human rights issues. And so it would be a ban on late-term abortions. This is a ban that is incredibly popular with the American public. So even people who identify as pro-choice still don't think that late-term abortions are okay. So you get these majorities of support for this ban that you don't see on any other abortion legislation. And you know, it's like solidly 2/3 of Americans support this. There is no legislation out there that's like this, and Gallup has said that one of the few trends that they can point to is Americans' overwhelming disgust with late-term abortion. And women are even more likely to oppose late-term abortion than men are. And so this was just, you know, this is kind of like an easy pro-life bill to pass. And all of a sudden, at the last minute, a few members of the caucus that were supposed to vote for this, in fact, including some co-sponsors, started raising a stink about the legislation. They said that they didn't like that there was a reporting requirement for the rape exception. So I'm not entirely sure why there was a rape exception to begin with, because there's no rape exception on the partial birth abortion ban, for instance. And even people who think that there should be a rape exception for abortion, they usually mean that once you find out you're pregnant, you can have an abortion, not like right on your way to give birth, you can have an abortion, which is a separate issue, or somewhat separate issue. So they said that they didn't like that there was a reporting requirement. They didn't think that was a good message. And what was weird about this is that these women had voted for the exact same legislation 2 years ago. So they had no problem with the legislation as written 2 years prior. And then all of a sudden there was this problem with it. And it's just kind of mind-boggling. But one of the things that I got to do as a reporter and as a journalist was point out some of the things that I've just told you right now. These are very popular bills. Now usually when the media cover anything dealing with abortion, they use words like controversial or deeply unpopular, or you know, they present it as if this is just a ludicrous thing that you might ban a practice that is permissible only in the most murderous regimes throughout the world. And just being able to write about it a different way was nice. But what was also interesting about it was, to me, how these members of Congress, who should be stalwarts, I think Carol said, you know, these are people who should be our allies, and in some cases, they're wonderful allies, and all of a sudden they got scared on this issue. And I think it speaks to the importance of remaining steadfast in the face of opposition. So I think what you have with a lot of members of Congress is they exist in a world where they are bombarded with a lot of liberal talking points. A lot of the people here in Washington, D.C. are going to have the same political persuasion, which is pro-choice and also just generally liberal. And they come to convince themselves that this is more popular than it is. And so I'm thinking that maybe this is what happened with some of these women, that they became worried about something that they really shouldn't have been worried about. Because this is an issue, again, that, so 2 years ago, people voted for this legislation. And it did come up in a couple of races. And whenever it did, it came up to the benefit of those who were pro-life. So again, because these are so unpopular, if you are someone who opposes a ban on late-term abortion, a candidate who's pro-life can use that as a way of demonstrating just how absolutely extreme you are on the abortion topic. So it was just such an illogical shooting in the foot on the part of these people, and I'm still trying to get to the bottom of exactly what happened there. But I do think that the one lesson that I really do think is important is that we remember that not to let the fact that the media are so overwhelmingly biased have too much of an impact on how we live our lives or how we talk about these things too. So 2 years ago was our first LCMS Life conference. It was wonderful, life-changing, it was great. I go to a lot of conferences and rarely do I, you know, walk away excited from them, but this is one that I get very excited about, particularly with, you know, today's speakers have just been incredible. But 2 years ago, I spoke at the Life Conference, and it was in January, and I had never really written publicly about abortion topics. I've been a journalist for a long time, and usually working in mainstream media, where it's not my business to share my own political views or views on life. And I've also been a media critic for a long time, which gives me an opportunity to look at how other people are telling stories and whatnot. So with the Kermit Gosnell story, this was starting to heat up after our last LCMS Life conference. And I had been following this story for a couple of years, and so I knew the details quite well about this abortion doctor in Philadelphia. I'd read the grand jury report, and when the story broke, I just thought, oh wow, this is gonna be the biggest story ever. It's got all the details that the media go crazy over normally. You know, a serial murderer. They love to cover serial murderers. You know, not just a serial murderer, but a guy who killed babies, a guy who killed an immigrant woman, a guy who had race-based policies where he would give better treatment to white mothers than he would black mothers, this despite being black himself. You know, like all the stories that, storylines and narratives that normally just really animate the media, they were curiously silent on this story. I mean, there were, we could go on, you know, talking about abortion clinic regulations and how his clinic had not been inspected in 20 years, how even the voluntary regulatory system that the abortion industry has set up also failed to uncover what was going on in this clinic. I am sure you, most of you know what I'm talking about, but this is a guy who ran an absolutely filthy, disgusting clinic where you know, there was cat urine in the hallways, where he kept trophies of his victims, and he kept them like in the same refrigerator where he put, where the staff kept their lunches and whatnot. I mean, this is just, yeah, disgusting, horrifying details. And the grand jury report that indicted him, I think they actually, like the name of the report was House of Horrors or something like that. It was, I mean, like they didn't pull any punches. It was really bad and he had all these charges against him. So when that grand jury report came out, it is true that the media covered it. Like even the broadcast media, you know, abortion doctor in Philadelphia indicted on murder charges. And I thought, okay, well, this is it, it's happening. We're gonna get finally like major stories covering this from the perspective of you know, what's going on here. And it was a one-day story, and it went away. So I caused a stink about this in my job as a media critic, like, why are you not talking about this? Why are you not covering this? And everybody said, well, you know, once it's the trial, then we'll cover it. But you know, how much can you say about a grand jury report? Which I think we've learned. Some grand jury reports are more interesting than other grand jury reports. But they, you know, I accepted that excuse. I thought, well, you know, this is kind of maybe something. And I just kind of monitored for 2 years. And finally the trial starts and I'm like, okay, now we get to see how they cover it. And I couldn't even critique anything because there was nothing there to critique. It was just completely absent from almost every single broadcast and print media outlet. And I was appalled. I couldn't believe it. Like, even the Associated Press had a reporter there, but they would only cover it in a local sense. Like, it would go out to the local Pennsylvania publications. So I was getting agitated and extremely upset. And I kept writing these very thoughtful essays about the importance of doing good journalism. And I'd get nice, pleasant responses. And then another day would pass with no coverage of this lengthy trial with absolutely salacious details. So one day, I guess you could say I lost it. And I was so angry. By the way, I have a little side note, which is that I like to use Twitter, which I'm sure none of you are silly enough as to waste your time on Twitter. But some days, my husband will come home from work. I work from home, and I'll say, I had a really good day on Twitter. He's like, you realize you don't make any money that way, you know? And I'm like, yeah, but it felt really good. Anyway, I decided that I would just start personally asking reporters why they were participating in this blackout of Gosnell coverage. And I just started, like, starting at the top and working my way down, or whoever it occurred to me to ask. So one of the things I'd found really interesting was that there had been a few stories in the preceding few months that had received a lot of coverage. One was when the Komen Foundation tried to extricate itself from funding the country's largest abortion provider, Planned Parenthood. Media loved that story, and they treated it as if Planned Parenthood was a very good organization, and you would be crazy not to fund it. All they do is kill 330,000 babies a year. I mean, who could have a problem with that? And they treated it like somehow Komen was the bad guy. It was mind-boggling, the bias that they covered that story with. But they really covered it too, so maniacally, first, you know, with so many stories over the course of a few days, that they ended up having to, that Komen ended up having to backtrack, or they chose to backtrack, I should say. And another story was something that we might remember from when our president courageously spoke at the congressional hearing. And there was some political theater, you know, on all sides there, but Sandra Fluck was not invited to speak, she not being an expert in religious liberty, which was the topic of the hearing. And somehow the media just, like, ran with this story. Side note, same PR firm handled Planned Parenthood and Sandra Fluck's PR that year. But I'm sure there's no reason to mention that. And then when a Missouri Senate candidate made his remarks on rape, you know, every single candidate in the country who was pro-life was forced to talk about it. This was a major story. I think the New York Times had like 5 stories before 5 p.m. that day on that, you know, and it just was day after day deluge. So I took those reporters who had really been interested in those 3 stories, and I would add up like how many stories they had written and then compare it with how many Gosnell stories they had written. And I got some interesting responses. So, you know, going after AP reporters, they would say, well, we did cover this. 2 years ago, there was a 3-paragraph story on page A38 of this paper, or, you know, whatnot. And some responses were unsatisfactory like that. And one in particular stuck out, which was a Washington Post reporter who had written, I think it was 88 stories. That was 8-8, or some, you know, 8-something. I can't remember exactly what it was. On Komen, on Todd Akin, and on Sandra Fluck. So I figured if you can get 80-some stories out of those 3 topics, maybe you could give us a few on Gosnell. So I asked her why she had done so many stories on these other issues, but hadn't done any on Gosnell. And she responded, Molly, I'm a health policy reporter, so I don't cover local crime. So she accidentally said that publicly so everybody could see, and I almost feel bad at what happened to her at that point, which was she heard from a couple thousand of, you know, the pro-life movement's best friends, and even people who weren't pro-life, they just couldn't believe that response, because of course all the stories that we have that become national start out locally. I mean, Michael Brown getting shot in Ferguson is a local news story, but it has national interest. Trayvon Martin getting shot in Florida is a local neighborhood crime story. It has national interest. You know, the shooting at Sandy Hook, it's just a town in Connecticut, but we all care. We all are interested in these stories, and we're all interested in what they mean and what the policy implications are and what they can say to us as a people and how that affects how we interact with other people. These are local stories, sure. All stories are local, basically. But that doesn't usually mean that the news doesn't tell people outside of that zip code what's going on. And in the case of saying that you're a health policy reporter, but you can't find anything to say about one of the most interesting health policy stories of our generation, whether it's about, one of the things I think is interesting is whenever people propose that there be clinic regulations of abortion clinics, the media will usually like either quote someone or not even bother with quoting someone saying, why would you care about hallway width? That's just clearly an attempt to get this abortion clinic shut down. Well, if you go to the grand jury report in the Gosnell trial that nobody in the media read, hallway width turned out to be a very important issue, not just because his hallways were not terribly wide to begin with, but because he was a hoarder and he cluttered the hallways. And so when the ambulance was called to rescue a woman who was dying in his clinic, you know, she couldn't be taken out of the clinic because they couldn't get through the hallways. So you can see that these types of details that are in this story, in fact, had tremendous policy implications for a health policy reporter, or even just how he would make different people pay different amounts for anesthesia, or he would have anesthesia options where the more you paid, the less discomfort you would feel, which is, you know, monstrous. And, you know, tremendous exploitation of his patients and whatnot. And, you know, if you don't see that this is a health policy story, this is going to be problematic. Anyway, I'm getting kind of carried away. But the point being that I actually want to convey to you all the importance of when you see tremendous problems in the media, I think it does make a difference to call people out on it, and anybody can do that. And this is the beauty of the age of Twitter, also that reporters actually tell you what they think on Twitter, which is such a bad idea for them, I cannot tell you. You know, because there are people like me just watching. But they convey how they feel about this topic, and I think that when you have that opportunity to say, see, when you said you were proud of Wendy Davis for filibustering a late-term abortion ban, that makes me feel like you're not going to cover my side of the story fairly. And actually just having that kind of conversation where you point to something specific and you show how that has hurt the trust relationship that you have with the reporter, they are human and they actually do care. And particularly if you say it nicely, it can make a huge difference in how they cover the topic in the future. Probably not going to get them to change from their position, but you can at least improve the media coverage. And media coverage is a huge issue in our fight here. It has been a huge issue for decades. I don't anticipate it going away, but every little bit does help. And if people really take the time to let their reporters know about how they're failing to cover this story accurately, it just makes a tremendous difference. Reporters are extremely defensive people. I'm one of them. No one's more defensive, I don't think. And there's no profession that's even half as defensive as most reporters are. So you have to handle us with kid gloves. But we also, you know, we read our email, we check our Twitter profiles, and so when complaints are made, it actually does make a difference. And so I would heartily encourage you to do that. And the other thing I was thinking about was that even though I've been pro-life since I was 9, when I first heard about what abortion is, I have never worked, you know, formally in the pro-life movement or anything like that, and I didn't even publicly talk about abortion until or publicly write about abortion from a pro-life perspective until sometime in the last 2 years. Everybody, though, has opportunities to advocate for this, no matter what your vocation is. And I think it's important that we think about how, you know, through our vocations, we have these relationships with other people, either in our family or among our close friends, or even just among anybody that we're interacting with day to day. And that is the most effective place to advocate for people who can't advocate for themselves. And I would just heartily encourage everybody to think about how to do that within their own vocations. And at the same time, as we are talking about speaking the truth here, I think it's important that we be loving in how we do it as well. And keep a good attitude about it. I was thinking about how everybody in the march yesterday, they have different ideas about how to advocate for the end of abortion. And some people are just more cheerful about it than other people. And you know, there's a time and a place for all different types of approaches, but I think it's important to be loving in how we interact with other people. I keep thinking a lot about something a Lutheran pastor told me many years ago, which is that the Lutheran answer to every question is, why do you want to know? And this has served me very well in discussing pro-life issues, and frankly, all other issues. Even just the fact that you're thinking that different people might have different reasons for asking a question already makes you more sort of humble about how you're going to respond. So if someone is wanting to talk to you about abortion, I think it's very helpful to find out why they want to talk to you about abortion. You know, is it because they had an abortion or they pressured someone to have an abortion and they feel tremendous guilt about it? That is going to yield one type of response. Are they thinking about having an abortion? That will certainly yield a much more time-sensitive and different response. Are they just simply curious and they just want to have a conversation about it? Well, you know, there you go, have fun. But finding out why someone wants to know something is a really important component prior to answering the question. There was one last thing I wanted to say, but then also I wanted to open it up to questions, and there is my pastor sitting in the second row, vested, ready to go at 4:30. And which means we have 22 minutes between now and when that service starts. So plenty of time for questions, but I just want to make sure we're aware that we have to be ready to go by 4:30. Is that right? Okay. So the other thing, I absolutely loved the question that someone asked during the lunch hour, or maybe it might not even been a question so much as a really wonderful statement about the importance of educating our children. And I sense that there's so, and some of you are barely out of childhood, so it doesn't even, what I'm about to say won't even make sense to you right now, but I think that people underestimate the importance of giving children a very solid education. And I am blessed to have a church that has a classical Lutheran school that is amazing and teaches my kids about Jesus every day and gives them a strong academic foundation and also just loves them. And this is very important. And I think that for a lot of people, they think education is something that can be done without these components. And I understand that different people have different educational needs and whatnot. But I think that we do not focus on the education of our extremely young children, of our, you know, of that pre-adult phase of childhood, at our peril. And it's too little too late if you focus after that. And I think that any interaction that you have with children and helping form in them their conscience and their healthy approach to these issues is extremely important. And I encourage everyone to focus more on that as well. Anyway, I don't know what you guys want to talk about, so feel free to ask anything. And yes, sir.
Yeah, this might not be much of a question, but I was just gonna say, you were talking about how like there was a media blackout on the gospel trial. Well, the same thing happens with the March for Life. It's actually bigger march than what the Martin Luther King Jr. March, yet you can hardly find anything on it. And often when you do find something on it, it's marginalized. Or like one time I found one on the march in San Francisco, and they tried to make it look like both sides were equally represented. And the pro-choice side, you can never find more than like a handful of people, so.
Right, this is actually something. So the question was about media coverage of the March for Life and how horrible the media coverage is. And it is true, it's so bad it's actually been written about in textbooks, media coverage of the March for Life. Now, one of the points you made though was that, I wanna kind of defend why the coverage is bad sometimes, because I think to care about this issue, you need to understand how reporters think. It is absolutely true that I assume you're speaking about the March on Washington where Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech, which I just listened to again earlier this week, is really a good speech. And it was, of course, the March for Life is much larger than that was. That was a one-time event at an extremely important time in history where it was, and it was also a very well-managed event. It was managed for high public relations value, and it was, you know, it achieved all of that. So I think it's important, you know, one speech really that really was the centerpiece of it. That's going to be more interesting to cover than the same march for 42 years in a row with roughly the same type of topics covered. And that, how do you, part of news is that it needs to be new. And this is an annual event, and there's a bias against covering annual events. It's sort of the same thing about why, if you look at how religion is covered, let's say you're a liturgical church body that has the same seasons every year, that you have, you know, you follow the same, you're worshiping in the Orthodox traditional historical manner. What is the reporter going to write about? It requires them to be smarter about how they cover something. It requires them to be much more educated, and a lot of us aren't that well educated. Versus, let's say you have some guy saying, the preacher says his sermon series for the next 4 weeks is going to be about sex. You know, of course that's going to get more media coverage than when you say, I'm going to preach about how people are sinful, sinners, sinful, you know. But to get in the mind of the reporter can actually help you think about how to communicate with them what you want. And so I think, you know, there was a tweet I saw yesterday about how if we were all there as part of a Wall Street organized, what is it, Occupy Wall Street protest, can you imagine how much media coverage we would get? I mean, we would be like batting reporters away from our doors. But somehow when you have hundreds of thousands of pro-lifers there, it just isn't news. Someone had a great idea, which I really, 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 truly believe we should do, which is instead of marching on the Supreme Court, we should march into the Washington Post offices and just parade around and be like, you see us now? You see us now? but I actually think that's a great idea, and I don't know why we don't do more like that, but you know, the photo editor who actually, unfortunately, recently died in Africa, but the photo editor of the Washington Post a couple years ago, he said something like, there's just no satisfying these people, meaning us, we're these people, those people. And I wanted to talk to him about that at some point. Like, you're not even trying to satisfy us. What your other point was is that, let's say there's a handful of protesters versus hundreds of thousands of people, they will treat that as if that's equal. That's actually happened before, including CBS News, it was a few years ago, they had more pictures of about a dozen protesters than they did that massive protest. I mean, it was shocking. And I don't even know what levels of bias can explain that away. But again, agitating on this has caused some minor improvements. And also, what's great is all sorts of other media are taking their place. And that's one nice thing about the disruption of media, is that new outlets can come in and provide other content. So there's always opportunity there. Yes.
Were there any significant or any repercussions for the reporter who answered you about the Gosnell trial, which is, you know, I'm not a crime reporter, since that was such an embarrassing remark for her to make, not addressing the issue? Was she...
The question is, were there any repercussions for the reporter who said she doesn't cover local crime? And I mean, on the one hand, yes, she now works at Vox, which is horrible punishment. But on the other hand, no, not really. And in fact, I hope you don't even know what Vox is, actually. You people are intelligent readers who wouldn't waste your time with that. But it was interesting. It did cause a lot of think pieces, they say, with the media reflecting on why they didn't cover it. And a lot of people did admit that bias played a big role in why they didn't cover it. But I hated the way the Washington Post responded to it. So they had their media reporter interview their executive editor about why there was not coverage. And he said, you know, people think that it was biased, but it turns out we just didn't know about it. I'm like, if you don't see that that's an issue of bias, I don't know how to help you. Like, if I were trying to be a major national newspaper and I didn't know about a story that was leading pro-life news reports for years, I would think that I'd made a major failure in my hiring. Even to not have someone whose job, even if you can't have a single pro-lifer on a staff of hundreds or thousands, however many they have, if you couldn't have someone whose job was to at least know a pro-lifer and write on what interests them, I mean, that would be very troubling to me. But I think a lot of people did these think pieces. They acknowledged that they completely messed up the story, and then they moved on. So on to ignoring the next story. Yes.
How do you rate Fox News and their reporting of this stuff?
The question is on Fox News reporting on these things. I'm much less critical of Fox News than a lot of media critics are, just because I tend to see all the problems in the rest of the media, and they only focus on the problems at Fox News. But they covered Gosnell. They even did an hour-long special report. But in general, these are difficult things to cover on broadcast media, and certainly all people who are in the Fox audience aren't necessarily pro-life. And they, you know, they're certainly not like stalwarts of covering these issues, but they will cover the March for Life, unlike some other media outlets. But I think that all broadcast television is going to be more entertainment focused, and abortion doesn't usually make for good entertainment. So I think there is opportunity for much better reporting on all sides. And I don't know if that answers it, but okay. President Harrison is raising his hand, and I know that that means he gets to ask a question.
I just wanted to offer some critique of your horribly biased reporting live on Fox News in favor of non-seat recliners against seat recliners on airplanes.
Yes.
I was offended.
So I'm surprised to learn we have seat recliners here in the audience. Yes, I do think it's funny, like, I will write about foreign policy, or I will write about domestic policy. I'll write these really heady, you know, I think really important pieces, and the only time the media asks me to come on TV is when they're like, we saw what you wrote about Beyonce. Could you please come on to the show tonight to talk about it? It's true, I did write that, but could we also talk about Iraq? And I think I did more media on my call for a national conversation on seat reclining, which is what it was. It's not, I do oppose reclining of seats, but I really just want us to have clear understanding, maybe a conversation before the seat is thrust back or whatnot. But I thought all tall people hated seat reclining. My husband's 6'5", and he hates it when people recline right into his knees, and that's what got me motivated on this. We're really off topic. Yes, back in the red shirt, or the red, sorry. No, this is... Absolutely. Actually, in fact, for the rest of this weekend, I'm helping out with a pro-life group that is really focused on just this, which is teaching people how to make their own news and how to make their own content. Not everybody is a writer, but if you are a writer, you absolutely can get published in a variety of places. Local is better, but they're, you know, sky's the limit on this, and there are all sorts of things you can do, even if it's just like an anniversary piece, meaning you haven't gotten coverage about your group that came out for the March for Life. Well, maybe they don't have a reporter to send along with you, but you could write it up, or you could pitch the story, or you can just, you know, write up your own. People love to publish, you know, here was my experience in Washington, D.C. at the March for Life type essays. You can do anniversary pieces tied to the anniversary of different events that are important to the pro-life movement, or making your own actual, like, really important news of trying to set up a memory garden type thing, memorial garden, is great too. So yes, that's great. And also, not everybody needs to be a writer to contribute to that project. If one person in your group is a writer, but everybody else can kind of help out with making contacts at the paper, or just inviting the local media to come to an event that you're doing or something like that, it's very wise. Over here.
Well, first, thanks for what you do. And second, the gay rights movement in our nation, media has gone to advocacy. They're not even all biased. Yeah. And I've noticed in the last 40 years, I'm wondering from your perspective, that you really, in the 70s and 80s, that's where media was on this issue. And have you seen, just in the time you've been critiquing it, that it's harder for them to go against the populace, which is slowly becoming more pro-life?
Huh. It's funny, because I was actually just talking about this on KFUO, about how if you look at public opinion polls of the media, where they were on gay rights issues 30 years ago is like even still to this point far to the left of where Americans are right now. So this has been something they've been pushing for, and they don't even pretend anymore to be objective about it. You have NPR, Washington Post, New York Times editors all saying, we do not feel that we need to do a fair job on this story because we think that that it doesn't need to be done fairly. So it's dangerous. But in this case, it was the media leading the advocacy. So the fact that the majority of the country identifies as pro-life, or that has at least pro-life aspects, or that this is an issue that is so popular among young people, I don't think it will make any difference because the media are also extremely. Yeah, they do. They're in an echo chamber and they are happy about it. Also, a lot of people who are powerful in the media kind of came of age, not just during the Woodward and Bernstein saga, but during a time when the women in particular were quite liberal, whatever wave of feminism that was that we were under at that time, kind of wrote, you know, that's kind of what the women who are in power now. So I think it'll take a while to see women in power who are more reflective of the actual public opinion out there. Okay. Yes, sir?
Yes, can you tell us who the men, our congressmen or congresswomen, who were the instrumental in sabotaging that bill yesterday?
Well, yeah, I can, but I kind of want to. I named two of them in my story on it, which was, one of the worst traits I have as a reporter is that I have horrible name recall. I forget, Renee Elmers from North Carolina was the one who was very prominent in sabotaging this. My reporting indicates that the person who actually led the charge was not that person, and I'm hesitant to name her right now because I've asked to speak with her because she's normally very pro-life, and I just want to understand just what the heck happened.
Can you give us her number?
I actually think it's fine at this point to really focus on Renee Elmers, the congresswoman from North Carolina, because she was the person who publicly advocated against this. She was a co-sponsor of the legislation. She pulled her co-sponsoring of this on the eve of the vote. She had also spoken to reporters a week prior about how she was concerned about the vote. She had voted for this legislation exactly as it was written 2 years ago and then changed her mind and caused just a complete debacle. I mean, the headlines coming out of this could not be worse. And so I think it's fine to sort of focus on her. But like one of the women was on the stage yesterday at the march, I think, if I recognized her properly. So I feel like we need to kind of figure out exactly what's going on, but at least insofar as Renee Elmers is concerned, she's publicly been out there, and I feel like publicly that gives us the right to go ask her some questions. Although when I have called her recently, her mailbox is full. So I think that she's hearing from quite a few people. But I do, don't just call her though, call your members of Congress. The thing that I want to emphasize about that really quickly, sorry, is that this was a bill that President Obama would have vetoed anyway. So it's not really even, well, okay. It's not just about getting the bill passed, although you know it would have passed the Senate this time, which is what makes it different. It's about how it was done. And so if you can have a vote where you carefully delineate the difference between you as a pro-life person and someone else as a pro-choice person, that's important and has electoral consequences, but it's also important for states that might be passing similar bans. And so how the fight is done is just as important as what actually happens under a very pro-abortion president. And so unfortunately people have given people who are pro-choice ammunition to use against pro-life people who support bans on late-term abortion, and that's why many of us are so angry about it. I feel like, there's one more. Yes.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Just wanted to follow up on the comments about writing letters to the editor and opinion pieces, and could you reflect on the difference in strategy of writing an anti-abortion letter to the editor versus writing a pro-life letter to the editor?
Yes.
Pro something.
Well, first thing I would point out is actually that letters to the editor are simultaneously the easiest way to get published and some of the most read things in any paper. And you probably note that actually, you young people don't even know what I'm talking about. Newspapers are written on things, but no. But it's important to, when you're writing a letter to the editor, you're not writing to the editor, you're writing to a general audience. So always think about how you're trying to persuade someone who doesn't share your views. This is whether you're writing a comment in a comment to a blog post or a letter to the editor, any type of thing. Just imagine someone you know who doesn't share your views and write toward them. And do you think they're going to be more persuaded by negative commentary, or are they going to be more persuaded by a, you know, constructive argument that brings them along? It actually might depend on the given topic. Sometimes just pointing out the horror of partial birth abortion actually is the most effective strategy. Other times, you're going to want to talk with, you know, just emphasize other parts of the pro-life movement, such as our great concern for mothers who are undergoing the stress of being tempted toward having an abortion or something like that. So it does depend on the issue, but definitely give thought to it. And you're not writing so that the people in this room agree with you. Just don't even worry about these people. Only worry about people who can be moved. So that also means don't worry about the people on the extreme opposite side either. They are a lost cause probably. Think about people who can be moved, and you'll be very surprised pleasantly by the results, I think.